I now continue with topic number 2. As I say these words, several days have passed since the Soviet Union allowed a Pan-American jetliner to fly the crew, passengers, and bodies of the two passengers who were killed from Murmansk to Helsinki, Finland. Everyone was released except the pilot and navigator, who are still detained in Russia for questioning. We have heard all kinds of stories in the major news media trying to convince us that the flight crew became disoriented, quote-unquote, that the navigation instruments of the 707 somehow misbehaved and misled the crew, and that the United States government is very puzzled about it all. But after the crew and passengers were rescued from the crash-landed Korean 707, it very quickly became obvious to Soviet authorities that the intrusion into Russian airspace could not have been accidental. For example, the navigation instruments on a Boeing 707 use what is called redundant design, so that the failure of even a major component in the system cannot destroy the accuracy of the navigational data available to the crew. As for the effects of magnetic compass variations in Arctic regions, these effects are real. But for many years jet transports have been using polar routes many times daily without difficulty, because there are standard techniques to correct for these magnetic variations. The crew of Korean Airlines Flight 902 were well experienced in polar flights and in using these techniques, and yet, for the whole episode to have been accidental, the seasoned pilot, co-pilot, and navigator would have had to miss the most familiar and unmistakable of all navigation clues, the position of the sun. Even some of the passengers said after their ordeal that they had privately become worried when midway through the flight the sun shifted around from a position ahead of them to a point behind the plane. As if that were not enough, Flight 902 just happened to enter Soviet airspace with pinpoint accuracy to pass directly over the critical Murmansk area. Then, faced with the menace of a jet interceptor alongside the 707, with its red Soviet star clearly visible even to many passengers, Flight 902 just forged ahead, deeper and deeper into highly sensitive Russian military territory. No, my friends, there was nothing accidental about the Korean airliner's flight into the frozen north of Russia. Those who suspect that it was an intelligence mission are correct. But that raises two questions that go to the heart of the matter. What intelligence information could possibly be so urgent that the lives of 110 people were put at risk in order to obtain it? And why was it necessary to resort to such a crude means of intelligence gathering? My friends, you will search the major media news reports in vain looking for the answers to these two questions. And your sworn public servants, so-called, in the federal government are busy trying to play dumb about it so they won't tell you. But if you will simply review the progress of events that I have been telling you about over the past 7 months, you will be able to understand what happened without any difficulty. The events leading up to the Korean airliner incident began 7 months earlier to the day, on September 20, 1977. At about 4 a.m. local time on that date, a newly operational Soviet killer satellite destroyed an American spy satellite over the northern Russian town of Petrozavodsk. The killer satellite involved was Cosmos 929, the first in a fleet of manned Cosmos interceptors, which destroy targets by means of charged particle beam weapons. The American spy satellite erupted into an immense fireball as it exploded in space. The display was so spectacular that it was seen as far away as Helsinki, Finland, and described as a jellyfish-like UFO in news reports here. Last September, in AUDIO LETTER 26, I described this first destruction of an American spy satellite in more detail. And on October 4, 1977, Just a few days after I revealed the existence of operational Soviet killer satellites in AUDIO LETTER 26, Defense Secretary Harold Brown held a press conference at the Pentagon. He stunned everyone by confirming the newly operational Soviet capability in killer satellites, but he refused to say anything about how they work. So many reporters have speculated incorrectly that they are of an old explosive unmanned design. During October, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 27, the Soviet Union launched 6 more Cosmos interceptors into orbit. All around the world they began blasting American spy satellites, and during October 1977 strange reports of fireballs in the sky peppered the news. Meanwhile, virtually the entire Soviet submarine fleet was deployed in attack positions around the United States to discourage any American effort to retaliate for the destruction of our spy satellites. By early November, the situation with our spy satellites was becoming critical, and Soviet military pressure on the controlled Carter administration was building fast. On November 18, 1977, the Voice of America was used to hurl a war threat at Russia over the spy satellite crisis, which I quoted in part in AUDIO LETTER 28. A preemptive American attack on the Soviet Union was being seriously considered by the Carter administration, but once again the overwhelming power of the Soviet Navy was used to stop that idea in its tracks. On January 24, 1978, Cosmos 954, the mysterious Soviet nuclear satellite, crash-landed in Canada. As I explained that month in AUDIO LETTER 30, Cosmos 954 was the very killer satellite that had been used 4 months earlier in the Battle of the Harvest Moon. But few people paid much attention a week later when Cosmos 929, the very first operational Soviet killer satellite, returned to Earth on February 2, 1978. Meanwhile, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 31, more than 30 Soviet Cosmos interceptors equipped with particle beam weapons were in orbit patrolling the Earth by then. Last month, as I called to your attention in AUDIO LETTER 32, the Kremlin repeated its SALT II surrender ultimatum to the United States. It was March 27, 6 months to the day after America lost the Battle of the Harvest Moon, and Gromyko delivered the first SALT II ultimatum at the White House. The official Soviet newspaper Pravda delivered the ultimatum using the language of diplomacy, and the jumpy Carter administration once again verged on panic. Only 2 days later it was announced that Secretary of State Vance would meet with Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko to talk about SALT II, perhaps in Geneva. But in the end, Vance was forced to make his pilgrimage, hat in hand, to the fountainhead, Moscow. By the time of the initial announcement of a planned Vance-Gromyko meeting, Leonid Brezhnev, number 2, was off to the Soviet Far East in company with Defense Minister Marshal Dmitry Ustinov. Brezhnev, number 2, is the ceremonial double who has been taking the place of the real Brezhnev in public functions, beginning a few weeks after the real Brezhnev's death in Moscow on January 7, 1978. It is now Ustinov who is the strongest man in the Kremlin. Ustinov is the new Khrushchev, allowing others to present the image of power while he is consolidating his own leadership behind the scenes. My friends, the use of doubles in politics and diplomacy is scarcely ever suspected by the public. After all, we are the ones who are supposed to be fooled by it. But at the diplomatic level, it is not an uncommon practice at all. And when a double is detected, a diplomatic tradition is not to comment about it in any way. To do so would be seen as interference in the internal affairs of another country, something for which the Soviet Union has no tolerance. So even though Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and others know Brezhnev number 2 is a double, they simply go along with the charade. Can you imagine? During a Far Eastern trip by Brezhnev II and Ustinov, Disputed border regions between the Soviet Union and China were visited. Rousing speeches to Soviet troops were used to extract shouted pledges from the troops to protect the motherland. But China was only partially the target of all this. On April 7, Brezhnev too made a speech aboard a cruiser in the port of Vladivostok, dwelling not on China but on the United States. The Carter administration was accused of vacillation and inconsistency in the SALT II negotiations, and the point was made that by stalling, the United States was on the verge of losing the chance altogether for a SALT II agreement. When American intelligence analysts heard that, they shuddered. SALT II is secretly intended to be America's surrender treaty through unilateral disarmament. The only alternative to surrender under an ultimatum is war itself, and Brezhnev II's words had not been chosen lightly. After the Vladivostok speech, he turned momentarily toward Ustinov for a nod of approval, and he got it. It was increasingly clear that the Vance trip to Moscow was taking on an either-or significance. Either Vance would find a way to continue stalling without raising excessive Soviet anger, or he would have to sign on the dotted line. If possible, delay is wanted by those who are controlling the United States government, because Operation Desktop has been reactivated. In January 1977, I revealed that the CIA had planted a fleet of undersea supermissiles on the floor of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, but that they had begun leaking and becoming disabled one by one. In one instance after I revealed this, the leakage poisoned whales in the ocean east of Florida, and they began beaching themselves to die in great numbers near Jacksonville, Florida. Today, the entire original fleet of CIA undersea missiles are defunct, but Operation Desktop, which originally planted these missiles in the sea, has been reactivated, and a new fleet of undersea missiles is being planted. This is being done under cover of drilling off the East Coast for oil. Many of the drilling operations going on there now are genuine, but Exxon, the oldest and most tightly controlled of all Rockefeller corporations, is being used in Operation Desktop. In August 1976, when the Soviet underwater missile crisis was secretly in progress, Exxon set the whole oil industry abuzz by bidding fantastic amounts in order to control large sections of the Atlantic oil field now being explored. Now, Exxon is using the Glomar Pacific drilling ship in connection with Operation Desktop. The Glomar Pacific is a sister ship to the famous Glomar Explorer, the Howard Hughes mystery ship so-called, which was used in the original Operation Desktop. So the American strategy is to keep buying time in hopes that the new fleet of CIA undersea missiles and other ad hoc actions can be completed in time to counter the crushing military power of Russia. But remembering the nightmare days of last fall, following the Battle of the Harvest Moon, the Soviet words of late suggested that any further delay by Vance in Moscow could be the last straw. It was concluded that for Vance to know how to play it, he would have to be provided with up-to-the-minute intelligence on the Soviet military alert status while the talks were underway. If it were found that the Soviet forces were in a posture of readiness to launch an attack, Vance would have no choice but to agree in principle to the secret surrender provisions of SALT II. But if Soviet forces were in a lower alert posture, he was to continue stalling with just enough concessions to avoid a total deadlock. A year ago, there would have been no problem in providing Vance with this crucial go versus no-go intelligence information, because a year ago, the United States still had a network of spy satellites in orbit. Now we don't. I can now reveal that the orbital fleet of the Soviet Cosmos interceptors has finished the job of eliminating America's spy satellites that can make observations in the Soviet Union. We have not retaliated, because we dare not. We no longer have the ability to detect Soviet ICBMs at the moment of launch, so any ICBM missile attack will produce only the much shorter warning provided by our early warning radar network, and we can no longer watch troop movements and other military activities continuously throughout the Soviet Union. So it was clear that a special reconnaissance flight would have to be flown in order to provide the intelligence Vance needed in Moscow. But the advanced air defenses of the Soviet Union could now shoot down any Western reconnaissance aircraft, including even the RS-71, which flies 20 miles high at 3 times the speed of sound. The only chance was to use an airplane the Russians might refrain from shooting at, that is, a passenger airplane. And to minimize suspicion, it could not be an American plane. As I pointed out 2 months ago, the disastrous aftermath of the Battle of the Harvest Moon had brought about a major rethinking of the announced Carter plan to pull troops out of South Korea. Someone suggested that this slowdown, which was already being planned, be offered to South Korea in exchange for a South Korean intelligence flight into Soviet territory. This plan was adopted, and the fate of Korean Airlines Flight 902 was sealed. On April 20, 1978, Secretary of State Vance was in Moscow. It was the first day of his talks with Gromyko. Seemingly by coincidence, that same day Korean Airlines Flight 902 strayed into Soviet airspace and flew around over a tremendous concentration of Russian military installations. By the time the 707 finally landed, American intelligence officials had their answer. The Soviet Union was not preparing for an immediate attack. The news was flashed to Vance in Moscow, and the stalling proceeded according to plan. The very next day, Jimmy Carter announced a delay in the troop pullout plan for South Korea. The Korean airline incident illustrates one very important fact that is often forgotten. Regardless of the weapons involved, strategy is always of paramount importance and can sometimes tip the balance against tremendous odds. And of all strategic factors, surprise is the most powerful. The Korean 707 succeeded in penetrating the most powerful air defense system in the world because the Russians were caught off guard. They were not expecting such a stunt. Just imagine, my friends, what the impact will be when the military might of Russia is combined with surprise in the war to come. Topic number 3. What I am trying to do in my tapes, my friends, is to help enable you to interpret the present in the light of the future. Once you understand where events are heading and why, you will no longer be mystified and caught by surprise by the turbulent events of today. But no one can grasp anything about what the future holds unless he has learned the lessons of the past. Looking at the Republic of the United States today, some of the most vivid lessons we should have learned from the past came out of the collapse of the French Third Republic in 1940. The collapse of France in the face of Hitler's military machine in 1940 was shocking, but it was inevitable. The seeds of defeat had already been sown in France during the preceding years, when France refused to recognize the reality of the threat and take action to protect herself. Like America today, France was eaten up from within by spies. Yet like America today, France felt safe behind its Maginot Line, and for public consumption there were continuous assurances that French military forces were adequate to maintain French security. The ability of France to defend herself turned out to be pure fiction. When the moment of truth arrived, The fine images and self-deception collapsed, and with them the French Third Republic. Today, the United States is nearing the moment of truth. Following a period of decay, self-deception, and image-making that parallels that of France from 1933 to 1940. Alexander Wirth, W-E-R-T-H, has written a book about that period titled The Twilight of France, published in New York by Fertig in 1966. In the introduction, D.W. Brogan wrote the following words, and I quote, "That France was beaten in 1940 was not surprising. Only a miracle could have prevented that. But not only had the world come to expect miracles of France, the world was dazzled by the victory of 1918." Unquote. And I quote again, "The French defeat was not surprising. What was surprising was the failure to preserve the fruits of victory, those minimum guarantees of French security." Unquote. Like France in 1940, the United States today is basking in the afterglow of victory long since dead. And like France in 1940, we have failed to preserve minimum guarantees for our own security. In fact, America has slipped even farther than France, because under the guise of arms limitation, we have shut down air defense systems, military bases, and Navy installations, and otherwise abandoned the defense of our own homeland. Historians are unable to find any precedent in history for such suicidal action by a great power. The twilight of the United States has now guaranteed that it is humanly impossible for the United States either to turn aside or to win a war with the Soviet Union. Only a miracle could do that, but we as a nation do not deserve a miracle. Instead of the faith in God that built the United States, most Americans now put their faith in the United States itself, as if it were a godlike being that could never go wrong and never be defeated. In the midst of the Moscow meetings this month between Vance and Gromyko, a Soviet spokesman reiterated for the last time in clear terms that this was America's last chance to sign a SALT II treaty. And despite the seeming improvement in the tone of the talks, and regardless of the seeming Soviet willingness to keep talking about SALT II, this was America's last chance to surrender by that route. The Russians know that the controlled Carter administration is stalling for time. They know about Operation Desktop and the other ad hoc efforts to find some military threat of significance to aim at the Soviet Union. And they know about the Rockefeller moves to try to turn China into a credible deterrent. But it is all too little and too late. The Kremlin has no intention of allowing these desperate maneuverings to bear fruit, but plans to cut them short with war on Soviet terms and at a time chosen by the Soviet Union. Since the end of the Moscow talks on April 22, 1978, the Kremlin has committed itself to a step-by-step clearing of the decks for war. There is no rigid timetable, but there are definite steps planned. The intention is to complete as many as possible before launching war against the United States, so that it will be possible to concentrate fully on America's conquest when the time comes. Even so, the Soviet Union stands ready for war at any moment. Very important to the Kremlin is a propaganda campaign which has already started to get the Russian people ready for war. The Soviet Union is going out of its way to seem reasonable and constructive about arms control in particular, while the United States is being painted as uncooperative and threatening. Another top priority has to do with Soviet invasion preparations in Canada and Mexico, which I described last month. After the initial surprise nuclear attack, the Soviet Union wants to be ready to mobilize its troops, tanks, artillery, and weapon caches quickly for invasion across our northern and southern borders. There is also the major matter of Red China, over which a tug of war has erupted between the Soviet Union and the United States. This is so important that 2 days ago Brezhnev No. 2 sent a deputy foreign minister to Peking for talks about the border dispute. In the days ahead, China will be increasingly the focus of attention by both sides. But the sleeping giant should have been left alone, because the pressures and inducements now being showered on China by the Rockefeller interests are tending to make China more revisionist, and therefore more similar to Russia in political thinking. So unwittingly, our secret masters are helping to bring Russia and China closer together, not farther apart. As war approaches, the United States will be plagued increasingly by sabotage and by acts of geophysical warfare, such as floods, storms, and artificial earthquakes, especially in California. But the biggest surprise in store for America in the coming war are the cosmospheres now hovering over our heads. Unlike the United States in recent years, the Soviet Union has never forgotten that quantity can be just as important as quality in a weapons system, and in preparation for the coming conflict, the number of cosmospheres deployed worldwide and especially over the United States began mushrooming early this month. Based on my intelligence information, as of April 26, 2 days ago, there are 216 Soviet cosmospheres armed with particle beam weapons now hovering over locations throughout the United States. There are 9 over the Washington, D.C. area alone, 3 each over New York City, Roanoke, Virginia, and Phoenix, Arizona. Also, there are cosmospheres located over military installations, dams, state capital cities, and other major cities. Presently, they are most heavily concentrated in the northeast area of the United States, but there are 12 each over California and Texas, and 9 over Kansas. The Carter administration knows all too well how close we are to war. That is why we are hearing more and more about a possible national emergency, gas rationing, and so forth. Congress knows too, but they, like the executive branch, refuse to tell you the truth. As citizens of the United States, we are now just like the trusting passengers of Korean Airlines Flight 902. We are just going along for the ride, trusting our pilots in Washington. And even when we see dramatic and disturbing signs that something is terribly wrong, we as a people refuse to accept the responsibility left to us by the founders of our republic. Instead of picking up the constitutional tools that were left to us to prevent disaster, we react like the passengers on the Korean plane who wondered why the sun was suddenly behind them instead of ahead of them. We think it must be all right. Surely they must know what they are doing. But, my friends, our republic is now in the hands of men who don't know what they are doing. They know all about lies, intrigue, and trickery, but they know nothing about honest leadership, nor do they care about it. And so the twilight of the Republic of the United States of America is deepening before our very eyes. We have turned away from the light of freedom that comes only from God, and we are flying into the darkness of war. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.